Hello, everybody. We are back for another fun-filled episode of Chop On. If you're joining us for the very first time, thank you for listening, and we hope that you enjoy our show. We appear every Wednesday in the U.S. at 8:30 p.m. EST, Thursday morning in India and Australia at 6 a.m. IST and 10 a.m. ACST. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Chop On Pod. We have our link tree attached to those pages for you to find the right podcast platform to listen to us talk about this blend of cricket and wrestling. And once you find that platform, please like, rate, review, but most importantly, make sure you subscribe so that way you do not miss one episode of Chop On. My name is Rajiv, and I am here with the co-author of Believe What Life and Cricket Taught Me by Suresh Raina and himself. Go get your copy from Amazon now. He is the one, the only, Bharat Sundaresan. Hello, brother. How are you doing this week?
Oh, I'm doing absolutely well, Rajiv. I wish I could match your excitement, but I've been running on 2 hours sleep cycles in the last few days. Of course, the World Test Championship final is on, and I think it's been a great advertisement for Test cricket, despite the rain. We haven't seen enough cricket, but the cricket that we've seen has been outstanding, which has meant that I've been up till the wee hours of the morning. I went to bed at 4, but as you know, when you're married to a teacher, it doesn't matter when you go to bed, and doesn't matter what you've done before you go to bed, you have to be up at 6:45. And so I was up at 6:45. Making coffee for my lovely wife, Isha, and packing her off to school. And I've been up, as you can see. I'm still running on just my first coffee for the day. Can't wait to dig myself into a second coffee. I should have made myself a cup before we hit record. But yeah, but you know me, I really don't need coffee or any kind of external influence to be all uppity up and, like, you know, full of energy.
No, not at all. And I've said to you many times before, you know, happy wife is happy life. So, you know, gotta do what you gotta do, brother.
Oh, yes, brother. Absolutely right. Yes. Yeah, I mean, there was a brief period 6 months ago where I was slightly concerned when Isha suddenly developed this great love for Test cricket. But my biggest fear was that would mean I would be exposed. Like, you know, once your wife starts reading your work, you're like, you know, sleeping next to your critic, which is never a good idea. So, that phase did last for a couple of test matches, the India-Australia tour. But then I think it phased out. So she hasn't been staying up till the VRs watching test cricket. So I've been allowed to sit there, watch, tweet, talk rubbish. And yeah, and we still have one more night to go. So ideally, I was thinking about it yesterday, whether we should defer this week and record today, which is when you're listening to this, which by which time the match would have finished. But then I saw your notes and I read something called a bonus episode. And I was like,
yeah, like you're saying, they finished day 5 of that World Test Championship final today. And normally that would be okay. But because of all the rain that you've been staying up late to watch on TV instead of out of your window, they're going to take full advantage of that reserve day. So I was hoping maybe I could entice you to do a bonus episode, and if you're game, I'm game.
Oh, I love bonuses, man. Like, yeah, absolutely. And, like, you know, we have I would like to believe a loyal fan base, a loyal viewer base, I should say. Fan base would be pushing it at this stage, but you never know. We need to tell them what happened. We need to discuss this greatest or the first ever World Test Championship final in detail. And we'll touch upon it today maybe, but we will give you everything there is to talk about tomorrow or maybe in a couple of days' time. I'm game.
All right. We are definitely going to do that for our fans and our listeners of Chop On. So be on the lookout for that. It'll appear right here on your feed. So you don't have to do anything extra. It'll just magically show up as a little nugget, a little bonus for all of our listeners. And if you've never listened to us before, first, thank you for joining us. We are going to take topics related to cricket and wrestling and discuss them for 5 minutes maximum each. If we end a topic before the 5-minute mark, then great. Otherwise, we're going to cut ourselves off at the 5-minute mark, and we know we have listeners that love cricket but don't understand wrestling, or they love wrestling and don't understand cricket. So we are going to enlighten all of our listeners by having a term or rule of the week and a history lesson. So let us walk up to this crease and rotate the strike, brother. That sound good to you?
I say yes.
All right, so I'm going to present these topics, and we will go back and forth discussing these. Here is our first one. India women versus England women ended in a draw for their test match. England in their first innings were 396 for 9 before they declared. India were 231 all out in their first innings. And England would ask them to, how about you follow on after that? So due to some great batting, India would go 344 for 8 before the match was officially declared a draw. Brother, I know that you have been talking about this match after each day on YouTube as part of the show, The Good, the Bad, and the Ridiculous with Melinda Farrell. But what is one positive and one negative that came out of this match?
Rajiv, I'll be brutally honest. This was the first time I sat and watched a women's test match. You know, I know it, and I'm not ashamed to say it. I've always wanted to cover women's cricket. Well, I got into the industry in 2008. And I remember in 2009 interviewing a lot of the women's team, the players in the Indian women's team, and they were leaving for the 2009 50-over World Cup. That was my first initiation to women's cricket. But back in the day, Indian women, as we well know and we've discussed in the last few weeks, don't play much test cricket, unfortunately, or haven't played too much test cricket since 2006. I think, what, 2 test matches or 3 test matches since. So there hasn't been much. But even when they have played, it's not been on TV. And also, I have been preoccupied with men's cricket, which is not an excuse, but I guess it makes sense. And I haven't watched much of it. So this was the first time I sat and stayed up and I watched all 4 days. It was rain affected as well. And I think the best part about it is we couldn't have asked for... I spoke earlier about the World Test Championship final being a great advertisement for test cricket. But this match in particular, and the performances we saw, and the performers we saw, I thought was the greatest advertisement for India or for women's test cricket there has been in a long time. There was so much criticism about the pitch, but I think the two teams, players from both teams, overcame all that and made it all about the cricket. Because you hear women's cricket, unfortunately, Rajiv, especially from India, invariably, it'll go back to controversies about, oh, is enough money being spent? Why is the BCCI ignoring? And it goes into that realm. And while those issues need to be spoken about, at the end, you want the cricket to take over. Once the toss is done and the players walk out, you want cricket to take over, which is exactly what happened in Bristol. And look at some of the names who popped up, not from the, just from the Indian team, but from the English team as well. But like, you know, for India, Shefali Verma is a superstar, not just in the making. She's just the superstar, right? Like, I mean, she's the heartbreak kid of women's cricket in my book. She's just a show stealer, just the way she batted at 17 to walk out and bat the way she did. Not just in the first innings, but in the second innings, to go after someone like Catherine Brunt, who was playing test cricket before Shefali was born. It just told you so much about her. Others as well, like Tania Bhatia on test debut, a wicketkeeper, was great behind the gloves, played that crucial innings to save the test for India. Sneha Rana, different story, 27, lost her father, was out of the team for 5 months, 5 years, comes back, makes a debut. And you know, and it was a great result for India in the end. Like, we speak about follow-ons and how India, and we will speak about follow-on later. I know, I have read the notes. But, you know, India's most famous rear guard effort or backs to the wall victory came in Calcutta in 2001, one of the greatest test matches ever played. The men's team, VVS Lakshman and Rahul Dravid, did what they did to beat Australia. And this, if not, it might not have matched it in terms of drama, but to have the follow-on enforced, basically being really jammed against the wall, and from there to fight and bat the whole of the last day on a tricky pitch against a world-class spinner in Sophie Eccleston, just tells you that this Indian women's cricket team is on the rise, but so is women's test cricket.
No, I can't disagree with you at all. I mean, a lot of the points that you made were pretty much what I had. I mean, this is just a positive for women's test cricket and the fact that it's going to be taken much more seriously now after this. I mean, how could you not when you have Heather Knight, 95 off 175, Sophia Dunkley, 74 off 127, the youngster superstar Shivali Verma, who batted like a true veteran in her test debut, just 17 years of age. Sneh Rana with the ball, 4 for 131, and then hitting 80 off 154 in India's second innings just to keep them alive and bring the match to a draw. That just told me everything I needed to know, that I definitely need to watch women's cricket more, especially women's test cricket, and we need it broadcast more so that we can all watch it more. And I think the only negative really for me was that weather played a spoiled sport in this one. If they didn't, I think we would have had a result, or at least been a lot closer to a final result. But there's just so much positive that I just couldn't find many negatives out of it.
Not at all. And the most exciting bit, though, is we're getting, we are looking forward to two more exciting test matches. India play Australia at the WACA under lights. Fingers crossed, I will be there covering that match from the ground. So we could do a live crossover, maybe Rajiv on Chop On. Then the Ashes, Women's Ashes test early next year in Canberra. And I hope to be there for that test as well. So a lot of good women's test cricket coming up.
All of those ideas sound fantastic, by the way. So let's plan for it. Let's do it. AEW is heading to New York. AEW president and CEO Tony Khan appeared on WFAN 660 on June 16th and announced that the company will make their New York debut on Wednesday, September 22nd, for a live Dynamite Super Show. The event will take place from Arthur Ashe Stadium in Flushing, Queens, New York. Tickets go on sale Friday, July 16th. For those that don't know, Arthur Ashe Stadium is a tennis stadium and has a capacity of 23,771 fans. What are your thoughts on AEW making their way to WWE territory in New York and holding it in a tennis stadium? Well, I think it's really cool, the venue, because it gives you a pretty intimate setting. And while it holds over 20,000 people, the way that the seats are, where they go pretty much straight up, it almost feels like you're right on top of the action, even from the very top of the building. So I think that is going to make this Dynamite in particular interesting. And the fact that it's the way it's set up too, it pretty much is well made for a wrestling event. You have the tennis court in the center, the fans all around it. So it's very easy to just slap a ring in there and make a quick entrance. So I think it's great. As far as if it's going into WWE territory, I don't know that that's a thing anymore. I do think that, New York is still considered the home of WWE, but the territory system has been long gone, and we can all thank Vince McMahon for that one.
We certainly can. And the first thought that came to my mind when I heard that bit of it, Rajiv, about are they going into New York territory into the New York territory, almost to challenge the WWE. It took me back to 2007 in Chennai when I was doing my journalism course. So the Hindu, the newspaper, is the biggest newspaper in the southern part of India. And like, it's one of those, it's almost like a religious post. Like the people in southern India wake up to the Hindu almost. And it's always been there for years. Some call it the slightly left-leaning paper, but it's got its own style. It's very, it's not conservative, but it's conservative in its style of reporting and writing. But anyway, it had dominated the southern space for years. And the Times of India, of course, the most read English daily in the world for those looking for some trivia out there. Also, we have 1.6 billion people. So, and also it answers your question about how many Indians can speak English. A lot, clearly. So if they can read English. So the Times of India was trying to break into that market. And the Times of India is like Vince McMahon. I mean, they know how to make money. And the one thing they did, you know, was what? Well, the first thing they did with their advertising campaign was put up this humongous hoarding bang opposite the Hindu office. And I thought it was just, and our journalism college was down the road, our journalism college was funded by the Hindu. So it became like a big deal. Like, you know, we would laugh about it, but we had to keep it hush hush. But like, they didn't keep it hush hush. And that's it's a random story, but it just came to mind.
No, that's fantastic.
Yeah. But I don't think and I'm totally with you. I can't believe it's taken a wrestling promoter this long to think about a tennis, a Grand Slam venue as a venue for wrestling. You're absolutely right. It's just built for wrestling, right? The center court, the center court is your ring. It's in the entrances, the way the tennis players make their entrances is actually very similar to what a wrestler does. You know, a lot of these events, they have the music blaring, maybe not always at Grand Slam events, but definitely for all of these ATP events, like especially for the bigger name players, which is what wrestling was like in the 80s. Now that we listen to Arn Anderson and Tony Schiavone with Conrad, that not everybody had an entrance music. And it's the same with tennis. So it's just built perfectly for that. Like you said, every person will have a great view of what's happening in the ring. They might not have to, you know, constantly oscillate like they would in tennis, so their necks won't hurt too much. But it would be a great viewing experience. And I did do some digging and found a really nice interview from Tony Khan, Tony Khan interview, where he spoke about how it's been a project 2 years in the making. So he's been thinking of taking AEW Dynamite to the Arthur Ashe Stadium. And Arthur Ashe, of course, the first colored man, first black man to win tennis Grand Slam. So he's one of the greatest tennis players ever to have ever lived, and a pioneer in his own right. But apparently Tony Khan has been pioneering this project, in his head for the last 2 years. He's always wanted to go there. Also learned that Christian Cage is a huge tennis fan. I didn't know that. So he's been apparently going to the Arthur Ashe Stadium and watching a lot of tennis in his time. And now to come to think of it, like he can pass off as a tennis player. He has he has a look of a tennis player.
Oh yeah.
So it's like a dream coming to fruition for Tony Khan. It's going to be a great experience for not just people who go there, but for us watching it. And I wouldn't be surprised if the WWE follows suit and, you know, I don't know. Of course, you can't ever take it to Wimbledon. They'll not let you do it there. But, maybe they can bring it to Rod Laver Arena here in Melbourne, right next door to the MCG, which will be one of your... it'll be one of your hallowed turfs to visit. I know when you come here, when I take you to because the MCG and the Rod Laver Arena are next door to each other. I mean, they're in the same precinct. The Melburnians call it the greatest sports precinct in the world. But here is where I'm going to surprise you. And it has no relevance to anything, but because you brought up the whole Tony Khan challenging Vince McMahon in New York, I did something which you tell me if it makes any sense. I went and looked at the head-to-head franchise record for the Jacksonville Jaguars against New York teams. And this is what I found out. Tell me if there is... firstly, I was surprised that they haven't played too much against these teams. But so their record against the New York Giants is 4-3 in 7 games. And against the New York Jets is 8-6 in 14 games. So they have a good track record of beating New York teams. Now you have to explain to me why they've played only 14-8 games against these teams. But...
Well, the Jaguars and the Giants are in two different conferences, don't intermingle all the time. And the Jacksonville Jaguars haven't been a team very long. They've been around for a little while, but not a long time. They haven't had a huge history in the NFL. So that could be why they don't have such a huge history with these teams.
But now I can see on your face how impressed you are with mine.
I'm very impressed, brother. And I like those stats very much because you know my feelings of AEW and WWE. But speaking of WWE, WWE Hell in a Cell took place this past Sunday, June 20th, from the Youngling Center in Tampa, Florida. There were no fans in attendance as it took place in front of the WWE Thunderdome. Results from the show: Bianca Belair retained the SmackDown Women's Championship over Bayley in a Hell in a Cell match. Seth Rollins defeated Cesaro. Alexa Bliss defeated Shayna Baszler. Sami Zayn defeated Kevin Owens. Charlotte defeated Rhea Ripley by disqualification for the Raw Women's Championship. Because of the disqualification, Rhea Ripley retained the title. And in the main event, Bobby Lashley defeated Drew McIntyre to retain the WWE Championship in a last chance Hell in a Cell match. Because McIntyre lost, he will never get another shot at the title as long as Bobby Lashley is the WWE Champion. Brother, from this show, what stood out the most to you and what maybe didn't go the way that you would have liked it to? I feel like that last one has something to do with Cesaro.
Yeah, I was a little disappointed, not just with that match. I thought it was a really good match. I mean, what else do you expect when you have Seth Rollins and Cesaro in the ring? But just to finish it that way, and the commentators, I think, made it worse where I think the face commentator, I don't know whether it was it Pat Mc? No, was it Pat McAfee?
Pat McAfee? Yeah, he's on that
Pat
team. McAfee.
Yeah. I'm not sure whether it was Pat McAfee or it was Jimmy Smith, but they kept, or I think it was Michael Cole who kept saying, oh, he got lucky. But if you look at that game, if you look at that match, I don't think he got lucky. I mean, it was a regulation finish, like a cheap finish, as they call it in wrestling. So it all just looked a little muddled in the end. I know what they were trying to do there. Now it's one all in pay-per-view, so they'll set it up for this big grand finale, best of three kind of feel to it. So Money in the Bank is the next big pay-per-view. Oh, yeah, correct. So I'm sure Cesaro and Rollins will fight it out there. It was, of course, Pat McAfee. Yeah, it was a SmackDown wing of the segment of the show. So yeah, I think that kind of it. But again, like the whole Alexa Bliss thing, I understand the catering to a different kind of audience. We've spoken a lot about how they're going through towards that whole cinematic feel to wrestling, at least on Raw. SmackDown feels more real than it has in a long time, thanks to Roman Reigns. But Raw just seems to be heading in that direction. So it was just random. I think it has a place in wrestling. There is a place in wrestling for something which is just really out there. Without that, The Undertaker would not have survived. I mean, we saw similar... Again, right? Like people who criticize Alexa Bliss and all that forget that The Undertaker used to walk out with druids and The Undertaker's soul, rose to the heavens. And even at its peak, I mean, the whole the Ministry of Darkness and all that, it was hokey. So its hokiness has been part of wrestling for a long time. And I think it has a place. I'm not a big fan of the way this Charlotte Flair, Rhea Ripley, Adelaide Zone Rhea Ripley is going. It's both Conrad and Eric speak about it a lot. You don't always need to have a baby face and a chicken shit heel. But at the same time, you can't have two, not even tweeners. They're just like somewhere in the middle. Like you don't know who's playing what role in that storyline. I just hope they don't burn Rhea Ripley's momentum, which she's been on a good run. I know Charlotte Flair will take good care of her in the ring and just in terms of whatever story you put Rhea Ripley into with her. But at the moment, it doesn't seem to. It's very tepid. It's a little underwhelming that whole feud to me. And yeah, but the most disappointing thing for me was because I did not watch SmackDown. And SmackDown comes to us on a Saturday. And yeah, Isha and I went for a permaculture workshop. A lot to talk about there, when we get off this, Rajiv. But I didn't watch it, so I kept fast forwarding on my WWE network, which I can still watch in Australia without a VPN. Sorry about that. And I kept looking for the Roman Reigns match. I was like, wait, are they? What happened to that? Are they doing separate SmackDown Hell in a Cell next week? I was so confused. And then I had to go online and check. And I read that last minute they changed it. They just had their match on SmackDown. So I personally was a little disappointed with that. I was looking forward to Roman Reigns and Rey Mysterio. Wow, imagine that. Rey Mysterio, man. Like, I was a child.
Still going.
It's like to think about it, right? Like that Roman Reigns is younger than me. I mean, no, I think we're the same age, or just a year younger than me. And he's taking on Rey Mysterio. So he would have been the same age watching Rey Mysterio.
Right.
So it's pretty crazy. So I really wanted to watch that. But yeah, anyway.
What about a positive that you took from the show?
I thought the matches itself. I thought even the Bailey Bianca Belair match was it was. I thought the match itself was really good. I liked the chemistry. They seem to be carrying each other quite well. I liked some of the moves that they pulled off, like, you know, just getting the kendo stick, just balancing it there and trying to use each other or trying to suplex each other on top of that. I like that kind of that move or that setup. And the matches were good, but the story is just, I don't know. Yeah, I think the Charlotte Flair, Rhea Ripley thing just was a downer. Yeah, the Bobby Lashley thing, I'm just glad that that's another positive. I thought that was a good match. I thought that was a good match. There was a good finish. And I think Drew McIntyre has kind of run his course as a champion, or like being the tippy-top guy, as they call it in wrestling. You know what's coming. Jinder Mahal is going to feud with him. You just know, because he mentioned him on Raw yesterday. I saw in that little skit at the back when they're talking about the Money in the Bank. So he started taking pot shots at Drew McIntyre. I mean, the three, what were they called? The three-man band, 3MB,
yep,
right?
The three-man band.
The two of them, against each other. Don't be surprised if Heath Slater just pops up from nowhere again.
Yeah, for me, the positive is that every match was solid, but most of them were solid until the end. So the best match of the night was easily Bobby Lashley and Drew McIntyre. It was hard hitting. They had a good story. And that one, for me, out of all of the matches, was the most believable. So that was my biggest positive takeaway. The negative, you know, last week I talked about referee credibility with the Impact pay-per-view, and here we go again, but in a different company. Rhea Ripley used a piece of the announce table and then boom, disqualification. How come it's okay to jump off the top rope and put someone through the announce table, or throw someone into the table, or throw someone into a barricade when it's a regular match? But the second that Rhea Ripley uses a piece of the table, bang, it's a disqualification. It's non-consistent booking that makes your referees look dumb and makes their credibility lack. So I don't know why companies feel the need to find the easy way out by changing the rules for one match, but that is not a positive thing to me. When companies start doing that, it makes me want to tune out, because if this own company doesn't follow their rules, why should any of the competitors in the matches follow the rules?
Yeah, and you know, I think the essence of it, I kind of get what they're basically trying to tell you is, when the feud is so hot, right? Like if Bharat and Rajiv are like, they hate each other so much, the rules just go out of the window. I mean, I think that's what they're trying to portray, wherein, like, you know, these two women just hate each other so much that they really don't care. They don't mind, like, you know, breaking the rules. And but when you do that, like, you know, the referee has to somehow randomly pop up from nowhere and, you know, disqualify you just so that the feud continues. I think it's like the old proverbial pulling the chewing gum, right? You cannot, like, just force a feud to grow. I mean, if you do that, this is what happens. You'll have to find false finishes like this to just make sure that there is. I mean, you know what they're heading towards. Like, there will be a showcase event in Las Vegas at SummerSlam. Going to be, maybe they'll be in a cage, or maybe they'll, I don't know. There'll be a gimmick match coming up for sure.
Oh, definitely. And speaking of creative, the board of control for cricket in India and Cricket West Indies have come to an agreement that both the Indian Premier League and the Caribbean Premier League can take place without one overlapping into the other. The organizers of the CPL have acceded to a request from the BCCI and advanced the dates of the CPL so that the IPL schedule can be squeezed into that limited window that Bharat keeps talking so much about of available dates after September 14th, when the Indian team is done with the England tour. The new arrangement was agreed upon by the BCCI and CPL authorities. CricBuzz has learned that the CPL will now take place from August 25th to September 15th, which will enable the IPL to restart the unfinished schedule around September 18th. Originally, the CPL was to take place August 28th to September 19th. All 33 matches of the CPL will take place in St. Kitts and Nevis. The BCCI is still trying to take care of a few more loose ends before making the official announcement of the remaining 31 IPL matches, which are likely to take place in the UAE. Brother, this is our two favorite cricket worlds colliding for the greater good. What are your thoughts on the CPL adjusting for the IPL? And what do you think of so much cricket being played in such a small window of time?
I'll come to the second question first, Raji. I'm not surprised. We're going to get a lot of cricket happening because we lost a lot of cricket last year. From March, say March 2020, I think from the time New Zealand and Australia played an ODI in Sydney, it was early March. After, and of course, the famous Women's T20 World Cup final at the MCG where 80,000 attended, 86,000 attended. Cricket just kind of, like with everything else around the world, there wasn't much cricket for a while. Then it took off with the English summer last year, and there was a lot more cricket. But now we can see a lot of cricket being crammed in. We've spoken enough about how the IPL was always going to come back and there's just too much at stake. And of course, there's nobody will be surprised with the fact that the Cricket West Indies board have said, okay, BCCI, whatever you do, you can have your way. I don't know whether how much our listeners know this, but for the longest time, for at least 3 or 4 years, that Cricket West Indies board or Cricket West Indies owed BCCI a lot of money. So what happened is 2014, West Indies had a full tour off India. They land there, but some of their senior players, Dwayne Bravo was captain. And so this is happening just before you got into cricket full time. So towards the end of 2014, they were in India, but they had issues with their own board, like the senior players. Eventually they protested like after four ODIs into a five match series. And they just said, we're opting out because we haven't signed contracts with our board. And the BCCI was not happy because it was a full tour. Five ODIs, three T20Is, and three test matches, I think. And you had only completed like close 25% of the tour, and now you're saying you want to go back because you have issues with the board? Because the BCC, it's a broadcaster-driven industry, right? The BCCI owed so much money. For years, the Cricket West Indies kept paying back the BCCI for that massive faux pas. But generally, we've seen most cricket boards to eventually... let the BCCI have their way for good reason. They are the most powerful body in the world. It's just a sign of things to come, Raji. I was also reading this piece on CricBuzz, the best website for news on cricket, and some random features written by Bharat Sundaresan, but also great features written by others. There's one on Devin Conway you guys should go and read, and that's not on the CricBuzz Plus app. I know a lot of people are not happy that there is a subscriber-based model also on the website, but this is free content. Go read it. Hopefully Devin Conway... not hopefully, he will get a bat. Hopefully he does something with the bat again. Only half century and still in this World Test Championship final. Just tells you how special a talent he is. But I digress. But I think it's just a sign of things to come. CricBuzz had reported a couple of weeks ago when the ICC announced their calendar for the next FTP about where there are a lot more ICC tournaments, Champions Trophies also added to the calendar. The BCCI earlier had a post. But apparently, one of the reasons they've done that is they're in return of getting a longer window for the IPL itself, because the IPL is all set to introduce two more teams mostly next year, which means it'll be a 10-team tournament. So what is now almost a two-month window? And when the IPL started, Rajiv, there was no window. For the first 7 or 8 years or 10 years, there was no window. It's really come into being. It's still not official, but it's come into being in the last few years where New Zealand were the first board to say, you know what, there's no point holding our players back. We don't want to rub them the wrong way. We'll create the two-month place. Just go and play in the IPL. A lot more teams will end up doing that. Australia have been lucky because it doesn't rarely impedes with any of their national team commitments. So it is this time though. So yeah, I think it's just going to be a sign of things where people just, when the IPL comes along, you just move aside. You say, all right, you have your free air, do what you want to do. But it's good also that the West Indian players who now with a lot of dropouts from Australia and England will feature mainly in the second leg of this IPL season will be free to finish their CPL commitment so that the CPL doesn't lose a lot of its charm, but they'll also be ready to go and play in the IPL.
Yeah, I'm personally glad that they're not going to be overlapping anymore. I love the CPL so much. That was probably, I think that was the second league that I actually got really into back when the Trinbago Knight Riders were the Trinidad and Tobago Red Force. I loved it. You know, it's great that cricket boards are coming together. I didn't know that fun fact about the Cricket West Indies and BCCI. So thank you for sharing that. That's quite the controversy. But, you know, it's good that they're coming together and they're amicably doing this instead of, well, I mean, we don't know what happened behind closed doors. But it's nice that they're coming together and there's a piece about it instead of one board saying, oh, we could have done this, but they're doing this and then we're going to do that. And they're just butting heads. So yeah, I'd much rather there's a peaceful agreement than something like that happening, especially because how much I love both Cricket West Indies and the BCCI. And, you know, as far as so much cricket being played in a small window of time, for me, it's going to be a little tough because of, you know, there's so much to do now. And everything's opening back up. If this had been a year ago and all this cricket was happening, I would have welcomed it with open arms. I'm hoping that I'll be able to watch most of it, especially with this crazy show that we're doing called Chop On. I definitely need to watch most, if not all of it. So I'll make the time, but it's going to be, I think I'm going to be like you, Bharat, coming up pretty soon. I'm going to be very, very sleep deprived. So we'll see how that goes.
Trust me. If you followed my Twitter feed yesterday, you could see, like, you know, sleep was beginning to affect me. But I'll be honest, I wasn't. It was such good cricket, and I'm sure there's a lot of high quality cricket coming up. So even if you are sleep deprived, Rajiv, you'll still enjoy every moment of it.
I agree with that. Who did not really like this was the West Indies. They played South Africa in their second test match. South Africa batted first and put up 298 all out in their first innings. The West Indies were 149 all out in their first innings. South Africa would then go 174 all out, and the West Indies rounded out the match with 165 all out, with South Africa winning the match by 158 runs. Kagiso Rabada took player of the match, and Quinton de Kock took player of the series. No surprise there. What stood out to you the most from this match? Well, Quinton de Kock again. It took 96 off 162. Dean Elgar did really well, 77 off 237. It looked to me like this was really a bowling match as opposed to a batsman match. You had Kumar Roach, he was 3 for 45 and then 4 for 52. And then Kagiso Rabada, who took the player of the match, 2 for 24 and then 3 for 44. So it seemed like the wicket was more of a bowler's wicket than a batting wicket. Honestly, I was really surprised to see South Africa get 298 in their first innings. I thought it was much closer to a 230, 240 on that pitch, but they proved me wrong. But, you know, sometimes that's just how matches go. You have a match that's going to be bowling heavy as opposed to batting heavy, and that's pretty much what this one was. And unfortunately for West Indies, it didn't go their way again.
Well, Rajiv, that's the pain of being a West Indies fan. I've been a West Indies fan for 31 of my 36 years, pretty much from the time I remember life itself. And this is how it's been, unfortunately, especially with the Test team. Every time you think they've taken two steps forward, they end up taking four steps backward, which is what this team has done. This is the first time South Africa were playing a Test series in the West Indies, in the Caribbean since 2010. And I thought this was their best chance because it was a young South African team. You know, Dean Elgar, very new to captaincy still. He has captained a few tests. Yes, they had a gun bowling attack, Rabada, Ngidi, Maharaj. But so did the West Indies. I mean, the West Indies have had the same similar test attack for a long time. And they had a very impressive debutant in Jaden Seals. But the batting was just appalling. I mean, four collapses. Once they were bowled out for 97 in the first innings of the first test, they set the tone and things have just not improved. They've not gotten any better. Yes, conditions were testing, but you're still playing at home and you should have made a better fist of it. If not, like, okay, you can understand one collapse or a couple of collapses, but, like, you know, for four collapses where you've really not gotten anywhere. And no wonder South Africa didn't take too long to polish them off. The best part about it was Keshav Maharaj getting a hat-trick. The first hat-trick for South Africa. A hat-trick in cricket is pretty much like a hat-trick in any other sport, but it only happens for a bowler. A batsman can never score a hat-trick. When a bowler gets dismisses three batsmen of three balls, it's called a hat-trick. And the interesting thing with cricket, though, is you can also take a hat-trick across two innings in Test cricket. So every team, like I said, has two innings. So if I get two wickets of the last two balls of A innings, I'm still on a hat-trick when I bowl my first ball in the second inning. So that's the uniqueness of cricket. But Maharaj did not need to do all that. He just took three wickets in the same over. And what a great moment that was as well. A great catch down the leg side by leg gully by Fionn Mulder. What to say about West Indies? Like, yes, the T20s will start. They might dominate. They might do really well. South Africa are still very much a T20 team in transformation. So the West Indies will win that. And then the CPL will begin and people will forget about this performance, unfortunately. So they do have two test matches, I think, against Pakistan. So, yeah, I mean, hope for the best, Rajiv.
Yeah, we might be singing the same tune again here pretty soon. Yeah. But what is different for us this time around is our next topic. We've never done a topic like this before, and it's a fun one. So on the 25th anniversary of the Hindi film Khiladiyon Ka Khiladi, Hindi film superstar Akshay Kumar posted on Twitter and Instagram a photo with the caption, "Raise your hand if you've defeated The Undertaker." In the film, Akshay Kumar has a fight scene with The Undertaker, but the role was played by Brian Lee, who portrayed The Underfaker for WWE in 1994. Akshay would go on to inform his fans that it was Brian Lee and not the real Undertaker. However, in a twist, the real Undertaker, Mark Calloway, would respond on Instagram saying, "Ha, tell me when you're ready for a real rematch." Akshay would respond to The Undertaker saying, "Let me check on my insurance and get back, bro." Brother, the first question for you is, do you remember this film? And what was the reaction like in India during this time? Because I remember that this film was a really, really big hit when it came out.
It was a massive hit. And for us kids, like, it was such a big moment, you know, when we thought that The Undertaker is, I mean, we talk about bringing two worlds together, cricket and wrestling, here in 2021. But back in whenever it was, I think 1994 or 1995, whenever the movie came out, it was, you know, our worlds coming together. We were all wrestling fans, a lot of us were. And to hear that The Undertaker was, you know, going to be in a movie alongside Crush, and it was the real Crush, it was Bryan Adams. They were going to be in a Bollywood movie. Was just, and Akshay Kumar wasn't a massive star at that point. He was just breaking into the industry. It might have been one of his early movies. I'm not a big Bollywood buff like you are, Rajiv.
Yeah, at the time, his big hits were anything that had the word Khiladi in the title. So I think this was either the third or fourth Khiladi movie.
Yeah, Khiladi, of course, is a Hindi word, which means player. So Khiladiyon Ka Khiladi is the champion of champions, or the players of all players. I don't know. Yeah, something like that. And not only was it a movie where we thought The Undertaker is going to be part of, or be a part of, alongside Crush, who was a big star back then. Crush and Adam Bomb were big stars in India. I'll just tell you that much. Alongside Tatanka. Because a lot of people, like I've said on other shows as well, thought Tatanka was Indian. Like, yeah, especially for young kids, right? This is before the internet as well, Rajiv. Something your generation doesn't know about. But but also the movie was based around this woman played by Rekha, who in the 80s was, or the biggest, she was the biggest female Bollywood superstar in the 80s, if not one of the stars, you know, like regardless of what gender she was. Was a superstar. She did so many movies. I think there is some record she has of having done X number of movies, more movies than most other, you know, stars of that era. She broke into Bollywood during the 70s. I am the last person who should be giving a history lesson on cinema, on film, but I do know that she played the girl next door kind of roles in the late 70s. Movies like Khoobsurat, I remember, was a big hit. If you've not watched it, Rajiv, you should watch it. It's a nice middle-class movie. When middle-class movies were a rage in the late 1970s.
No, but great.
Yeah, and through the 80s, she was the lead actress. She was in pretty much every other blockbuster movie. And by the mid-90s, though, she was trying to, you know, she was on the wrong side of 40, if I'm not mistaken, and she was trying to reinvent her career. And she played the role of a wrestling promoter, of all people, an evil wrestling promoter, or a villainous wrestling promoter in the US. And Akshay Kumar, I think, plays a cop who's sent from India to for some reason to stop or bring down her wrestling promotion. And there he needs to overcome the Undertaker and Crush. Or so we thought. And then it turned out, I remember watching the movie. I don't remember watching it in its entirety, but we did fast forward to the wrestling bits of it. And the first moment we were like, what happened to the Undertaker's 7 feet frame? He looks much shorter. And then once they zoomed into his face, you were like, wait, I know this guy. This is the Undertaker.
Right.
who was then chains, if I'm not mistaken, in the Disciples of Apocalypse, right? Like Brian Lee. And there's that wonderful photo of them going around these days with Paul Bearer, Brian Lee, Mark Calloway, and Paul Bearer, William Moody, his name in real life. So it was disappointing, but we were at least happy that the real Crush came along. So it would have been quite an interesting experience for them. And this is when I thought there would be a lot of intermingling of wrestling and Bollywood, because wrestling was really coming through the ranks a big thing in India in the 90s. You know, cable, I've spoken about this a lot in the past, like cable TV just broke into India in the early 90s and wrestling came along with it. Wrestling came to, as Eric Bischoff now knows, wrestling came to India before Friends did. So, you know, it was for a lot of my generation of kids, like it was our first exposure to America as a country. So, but it was also a very risque movie, had this shower scene with this middle-aged woman. By then, Rekha was no longer this young heroine, like a young superstar. So it was quite an interesting movie for its time. And if I was the WWE, or forget about me being the WWE, this is a question to the WWE. What are you doing? The Undertaker has 3.6 million followers. Akshay Kumar has 50.6 million followers on Instagram. If you don't put together Akshay Kumar versus Undertaker anytime soon, and to add, Akshay Kumar is a big MMA buff. He is an MMA, he's a trained MMA performer. So I don't think he's really done too much of it on the big stage. But he is, of course, in his 50s. So is The Undertaker. But he's one of the fittest people in Bollywood. He always has been. Maybe we will see Akshay Kumar. And finally, the breakthrough will come through Bollywood in for wrestling. So Akshay Kumar versus Mark Calloway or The Undertaker, I'm all for it. And WWE, if you don't like jump on it, then you're being foolish.
No, I agree with you. They need to do like a behind the scenes something, or have a Akshay Kumar versus the real Undertaker and do some sort of cinematic type of match. That would be super cool, because for one, it would be good crossover. And if they only put it on the WWE network, that'll bring more subscribers to the WWE network, especially like you said, Akshay has over 50 million followers on Instagram. So there's that. I think it's really cool though, that Undertaker responded the way that he did. I wonder if maybe for 1 second he saw it and went, when did I do that? And then went and looked at it and then goes, oh, okay, that wasn't me. Okay. Because, you know, he's had such a long career. I'm sure he wouldn't have put it past himself to do it. So. But that was super fun. Yeah. Super fun. A super fun interaction between the two of them. And I'm glad that two of our worlds are mingling together like that. So that was a lot of fun. Moving on to our next segment here, fact or fiction. I will present a topic and we will each say whether we think it is fact or fiction and make arguments as to why that is. The first topic here, AEW needs another championship in their company. Brother, is that fact or fiction?
I'm going to stick my neck out and say I think it's a fact. Generally, you know, you always say less is more in wrestling, or less is more in life. Like I said, you're talking to someone who attended a 6-hour permaculture workshop, so I'm all about minimalism. But just the way that roster is building, and now you're hearing names like Aleister Black coming on board, and so many others, and you know, they're female division, women's division also is constantly growing. I don't know. I mean, I just pulled up all the championships titles they do have. I mean, of course, there's a AEW World Championship, which is Kenny Omega, and the TNT Championship, which acts as their secondary intercontinental / TV title, depending on which era we're talking about. And then they have the Women's Championship, the Tag Team Championship. And then there's the FTW Championship, but correct me if I'm wrong. Do they have too many matches around the FTW title? Not too many. Right?
Not too many. Just there's been a few here and there, mostly on Dark. Yeah.
Exactly. So I don't know. I wouldn't recommend just randomly just throwing in a cruiserweight title there, but they could come up with a non-gimmicky title. I don't know what you would call it, but it, like, I remember during the peak of the Attitude Era, there was the World Heavyweight title, there was the Intercontinental title, but I loved the European title. Like, you know, D'Lo Brown was the made European champion. I think Owen Hart held it for a long time as well. Like, so many guys like Triple H and The Rock came through the ranks winning that European championship and then finally progressing to Intercontinental and beyond. So just because of the roster size, I don't think it's a bad idea to stick another singles, men's singles title in there. I'm not so sure about a women's tag title yet for AEW. Maybe they might go for it in the future. But for me, I wouldn't mind just a tertiary title in there. So you can have a lot of guys kind of come through the ranks and then why for the TNT title and then thereon go and compete for the World Heavyweight title.
I'm going to go with fiction on this, and here's why. One of the things I really like about AEW is that they have a story for almost everything that's on their show. And one of the things I critique WWE about is a lot of times there are things happening which are just happening and there's no real story. So you'll have a random Miz versus Dolph Ziggler match for the Intercontinental Championship for no reason other than it's on the show. And I would just hate for AEW to add more titles to the show and then feel obligated to use that title all the time. And that's something that WWE does all the time. And I think Impact can be guilty of this at times too, with their X division title. And they had the Grand Championship and the Heavyweight Championship at one time. So as long as AEW is doing what they're doing now, I don't think another championship is required, because a lot of their stories have a reason for people to fight as opposed to having only a championship to fight for. And if you have less titles in your company, I think it means that much more when you get your hands on the title, because if you have like 5 championships, you can go get a championship anywhere. Sure, they're at different levels, but that's what makes having these titles that much special, that much more special, because there isn't a lot out there in the company right now to go get. So when you're able to fight for it, when you're able to capture it, that makes it that much more special to have it.
A polite disagreement there, I do sense, but I just think also I would, just to support my statement or my take on this, me calling it a fact, is the fact that they do follow a very sports style format, right, where there are rankings and ratings. That just adds, like, you know, I cover a sport which has lots of formats, Rajiv. So I'm all for more formats. I'm all for that one extra title, because you're talking about rankings, like, and if the rankings only lead to those two landmarks, the World Heavyweight title and the TNT title, yes, it makes for more competition. But just adding one more, because, and purely based on the roster size now, which is constantly growing, they might just have something in there. Maybe add something, like, you know, you have so many of these former WWE guys join there, Big Show, Mark Henry. Why not have a title, like, you know, where it's coach based? I don't know, just throwing it out there, where, like, you know, you get coached, like, you know, the title, it becomes a sort of some sort of tournament where you use those guys as well as managers, not just as classic wrestling managers where, you know, you just accompany and trip people, but as coaches. Like, you know, we hear about coaches in the background, but, you know, having a coach-based title tournament, not tournament, but like a system there, I don't know. just Tony Khan, of course, you listen to this, so there you go.
Of course he's listening. How could he not? He's a Khan. He likes cricket and wrestling. We know this.
That's a good point. I've always wondered why they've not had I know he's only half Pakistani, but I would love a Pakistani something element on that show. Like, you know, we've spoken so much about India, and I've been waiting for it. Like, and or want to know if Tony Khan has any interest in cricket, because I've read about his father. His father, Mohd from Lahore, did play cricket as a kid, so there is some cricketing interest there. So yeah, I mean, hopefully, like we always want to bring two worlds together, and hopefully Tony will help us do that.
And if not, then when you meet him eventually, you can help him. So there we go.
Of course, that's gonna happen. That's just inevitable.
Becky Lynch coming back will bring some missing energy to the WWE product. Is that fact or fiction? I think it's 100% fact. There is something missing in the women's division now. Some of it was brought back when Charlotte came back in a more full-time capacity, but there's still a little something missing. Yeah, Bianca Belair and Bayley just had a great match at Hell in a Cell. Yeah, Rhea Ripley and Charlotte are tearing it up as well, but there's other women in the division that aren't really getting too much of a spotlight. Like a Shayna Baszler right now could really use a Becky Lynch. I mean, she's in this whole storyline with Alexa Bliss, and it's a lot more cinematic based, but Shayna Baszler she's a badass, and she needs another badass to come out and bring her to that level that for some reason, since she's come up to the main roster, she hasn't hit. She was a really big deal down in NXT. She's coming to the main roster and she's kind of floundering, especially with this feud with Alexa Bliss. Sounds like we're, you know, just playing a broken record here, because that seems like it happens all the time. You're doing really well in NXT and then you get to the main roster and nothing happens. But Becky Lynch, not only with her in-ring product, but her character, she was cutting the best promos before she left. She was building great stories with all of her opponents. She was the division at one point in time. So to have her back is going to be like a much needed shot in the arm that WWE needs.
I mean, anybody who disagrees with that and calls it fiction that knows nothing about wrestling. I'll stick my neck out to say that, because Becky Lynch at one point was the most over wrestler, man or woman, male or female, on the roster. And, you know, you speak of Shayna Baszler, that was WrestleMania, one of the WrestleMania main events last year, right? Shayna Baszler, when she came in on beast mode, where she was biting and, like, you know, biting flesh off the other women, destroying women in the Elimination Chamber, and, you know, falling short to Becky Lynch. But Becky Lynch just brings so much energy, and her promos, like you said, are great. And every storyline that she's been in, she's enhanced her opponent as well. Her opponent's profile has also grown, which is what you expect from the best in the business, which is what Becky Lynch is. I mean, yes, she's now a wonderful mother. And like, I saw a lovely picture of Seth Rollins and his daughter, if I'm not mistaken, the other day. And yeah, I mean, I'm sure when she's ready, she'll just... and as good as Charlotte Flair is, and maybe it's not her fault, she invariably gets put into very familiar storylines. I've never seen Charlotte Flair in a storyline which doesn't revolve around either her lineage or either about how she's the most successful wrestler in a long time, or her regardless of whether she's, sorry about that, face or heel. They always make her sound a little haughty about look who I am. So Becky Lynch coming back and maybe challenging that, it's happened in the past, but I'm sure with Becky Lynch, they can think of a different level of storyline. But also, she'll just lift the women's roster and just lift the promotion itself when she comes back, and make others look better as well.
In the future of the World Test Championship, they should add more days to the final so they can play 5 full days no matter what. But I can see it on your face what your answer is going to be. Is that fact or is it fiction?
Oh, this is what social media does to the world, Rajiv. Like, yeah, now everybody wants, like, yeah, so many people have to have, first of all, it's absolute fiction. It's like nonsense, that idea. Like, you know, they should just have 450 overs. And then don't play test cricket, then don't watch test cricket. The beauty of test cricket is, like, yeah, I mean, rain plays a part. And I was on her radio show yesterday where I said, look, losing day four has really, like, you know, affected this test match. But now we are getting a full day today, day six. So, but, you know, the beauty of test cricket is the covers, rain, groundsmen, everybody got TV time. I mean, the covers and the groundsmen got a bit more TV time than we wanted them to, but they did. I thought the first three days of this World Test Championship final were great. I know we lost the day to rain, but look, it's part of cricket. It adds the charm to test cricket. I know we all want to see 450 overs and a whole test match, but it should always, like, would we be talking about the timeless test, right? If it didn't end with England just 40 runs short, but, you know, for all our listeners there, we will do a history lesson on this someday. But in the late 30s, before the Second World War, England and South Africa attempted to play a timeless test. They said, okay, we'll just play till there is a winner. And this is back when cricket was played at a very slow pace, not at the pace at which we've gotten used to. But this test match final has gone back to where batting was really difficult. Uncovered pitches, another topic for a history lesson someday. Cricket was always played on uncovered pitches back then till the 19... I'll do my history lesson and tell you till when. But till 50, 60 years ago. But anyway, so they started playing this test match. England was set this massive total. They reached within 40 runs of getting to that target, but they had to leave because they had to take the ship back home. So, and if that hadn't happened, would we be speaking about it in the same way we are now? I don't think so. So that's the charm of test cricket. Yeah, it's just silly. It's just because it's a classic, you know, in Hindi, they say, "Ungli diya to haath pakadna," which translates to, if you give someone a finger, they want your arm next. So I think it's just ridiculous. Like, you know, all the calendar is hectic and tight as it is. You can't just be adding. And just, you know, on a practical side as well, it's easy for you and me to sit here and say, one more day of cricket. Who's going to bear the cost for all the broadcasters, like, you know, all the camera crew and all that? It's not cheap. So you can't just randomly add another day. So it is, I'm happy that they have an extra day here. And I'm very confident that we'll see a result with India winning, but we'll wait and watch.
Oh, it's 100% fiction. I'm with you on that. I'm glad that they are doing a reserve day. So I think that at most is what we need. But just to keep adding days on just so that we can get a full five-day match in is absolutely ridiculous, because test cricket is test cricket. If you haven't accepted it by now, then just don't watch it, because you're not ever going to accept it. I don't like the prospect of 450 overs. That to me is not a good idea. But I'm also, like you, a huge fan of test cricket in general, and it's the most pure form of the game, and it really puts your batting to test, it puts your bowling to test, it puts your patience on the field to test. It is just a way to figure out, even as a player, do I really love cricket, or do I think I love cricket because of the shorter formats? So let's keep it the way it is. It's perfectly fine. Like I said last week, I think it was, or maybe even the week before, I still am not crazy about two sides holding the trophy if there's a draw, but I'm with you. Don't add extra days. There's no reason to. Keep it the way it always is, because that's how we got to where we are now. If it wasn't for test cricket being what it was, cricket exactly would not be where it is today.
Yeah, and test cricket, they say, is the greatest metaphor for life. And when has anything ever been perfect in life? So let's just keep it as imperfect as it is.
The Bharat Army at the World Test Championship Final was entertaining. Is that fact or fiction? And I am going to say fact. And here is why. They were on fire the whole day that they were out there. And they were playing the dhol. They were dancing. They were hooting. They were hollering. They were having a great time at this World Test Championship Final. And what else would you want for your fans than to be there having a great time and enjoying test cricket that is happening in front of them? I mean, in England, when England's playing their own matches, they have those section of fans that are cheering. They have their sayings, they have their songs. You know, the same happens in soccer or football, as it's called over there. And it just, to me, it really added to that day that they were out there. But based on your face, brother, I feel like you feel a little differently than I do.
It might sound a little controversial, but I'm going to go fiction, and not because we don't need them. We don't need them at the crowd. The statement is it makes it entertaining. So it's not my kind of entertainment. Let me just stick my neck out there. And I know some of the Bharat Army, fans, and they bring a lot of energy to the cricket. I know, especially outside India, the cricket boards love them, love having them at the grounds. They have different factions as well within the Bharat Army. Like there is an Australia wing, there's an England wing and all that. But the Dole takes away from cricket, because it's just that it gets played everywhere else. I've always said the one uniqueness about the Bami Army, which is where the Bharat Army idea comes from. The Bami Army is English. Are the group of English fans who started, I think, in the 90s, and now they're their own beast now. It's a corporate setup almost, the Bami Army. The Bharat Army is headed that way. And for them, it's the trumpet. It's kind of stands out. The Dhol is an Indian instrument, but you go to anything. I see a lot of people on Twitter talking about how it sounds like you were at an Indian wedding, for example, which is I'm sure they can come up with something more unique. And Indians are the most creative people in the world. So it doesn't fit my criteria of entertaining. That's why I call it fiction. They have a place for sure. And I just think they can bring a different, it just becomes too stereotypical. It's that very stereotypical. What they bring to the crowd. Look, they're great fans. Without them, I would not have a job, and we would not have a sport like cricket. So the fans are really important, and you need them out there in their numbers, braving the weather. We saw so many of the Bharat Army members brave the heat. Rajiv, I need sleep. Brave the rain, even on day four when there was no play and was kept pouring, they hung around till the end of the day to be told, okay, now leave, there is no play today. So that's what keeps our sport relevant. But I just find it, I look at it the same way I look at Indian restaurants overseas, right? Now that I live away from India, people just need to know, Australians and the Englishmen, that's not just India. The India has so much more variety. It's when you talk about Indian food, you hear about curry and you hear about the same butter chicken and the vindaloo and those things like the Rogan Josh. But that's just one section of India, very small state of India. Every state is different. I just want the variety and the diversity of India, which is the beauty of India, to be displayed, to be showcased at the cricket ground, and not just that one bit. That's it.
It's almost like they are the modern day Maharaja of fans.
It is. The Bhangra is just it's not an Indian dance. It's a state dance, right? Every state has its own. I'm not saying you want it to be a Republic Day parade, but I'm just saying that can be where you have every state represented, but it can be different. It can just be a lot more. But yes, it is like the modern day Maharaja, who's back, by the way.
He is back, and we could not be more excited. I know I'm excited. I know how you and I both feel about his character, but I'm excited to see him back on TV.
I'm just waiting for those two, his cohorts, to turn on him and, for Rinku Singh to make a big, we should be writing wrestling TV.
Seriously. I know. Rinku Singh needs to become a big, big, big deal.
Akshay Kumar's backing. Think about it.
Think about it. Akshay could walk him to the ring at WrestleMania. Come on. God. While we're over here fantasy booking, we're going to move on to terms and conditions with our resident expert, Bharat Sundaresan. So in the women's test match between England and India, they had this rule that came into play of the follow-on. So, Bharat, can you explain to our non-cricket watching fans or listeners, what is a follow-on in cricket?
All right. So, the follow-on in cricket was basically, it's there only in test cricket when you have two innings. It's not just it's not just played over one inning. So the concept, it's been there for forever, if I'm not mistaken, and it basically is there. Before I get into the nitty gritty of it, is there to especially in a circumstances like where it's a rain affected game, it comes in very handy. Wherein if one team is so dominant that they should get a chance to they don't need to bat again. Okay, I didn't say phrase it correctly. So if one team puts up such a big total on the board and then they're so dominant by bowling the opposition out cheaply that they should get an opportunity to wipe the game out. It's like a 2 out of 3 falls kind of thing. Like, you know, win it with 2 falls. You don't need to go into the third fall. So in a cricketing sense, what that means is if I bat first and I make 600, like England in that match against the Indian women, the English women made 396. So if the Indians get close to that target, you get a lead and you bat again and then you set a target for India in the second innings. But the follow-on basically means that if you're nowhere close and there's no point of you coming, you as the batting team coming out again and batting and like you're just occupying time and space, you are given the option to put them back into bat, you know, make the opposition bat a second time, like, you know, back to back, and then bowl them out with before, like, you know, so what you're trying to ensure is they don't get to your target after batting both innings, which means you don't have to bat again and you win by an innings, as they say. So the nitty gritty of it is in 5-day cricket, it's basically whatever you score above 200, you need to make at least 200. So if Rajiv Levin bats first and Rajiv Levin makes 250, so to avoid the follow-on, Bharat 11, the Bharat Army, has to make one run more. You need to get to 51. So if I make 51, then you can't enforce the follow-on. And you always have the right. Like, it's not that if I get bowled out before, if my team is all out within, like, you know, or and we're not within 200 runs of your target, it's not like an automatic follow-on. The team batting first always has the opportunity to enforce the follow-on. You can always say, no, it's fine. I'll bat again, like, you know, increase the lead and set them 800 to win, which does happen in cricket. So that's pretty much what the follow-on is. In 4-day cricket, the number of runs change. So in that India-England women's match, it was 150 runs. That's why England had the opportunity to enforce the follow-on. And it's a rule which, or it's not a rule, it's a tactic which doesn't get used very often. It really depends on a lot of factors, on conditions when you're playing in the subcontinent. How many overs have your bowlers bowled? Like, you know, how hot is it? Like, do you want to risk your bowlers by, you know, bowling them into the ground? Because the chances, like, generally the team bats better in the second innings. When a team is asked to follow on, they kind of recover and, like, you know, they get their bearings right. Most times, 7 out of 10 times. So you need to be aware of that. Then you have to take into consideration what time of the series is the first match, is the last match. What if you have 3 more test matches to go? And also, it also is a question of if, say, you made 550 and the opposition gets to 320 and gets bowled out, you technically can still enforce a follow-on. But the fact that the opposition has made 320 means your bowlers are already tired. Do you want to put them through the grind again? And also, you need to take into consideration how much time is left in the game. So, you know, and everything changed during that test match I spoke about earlier when India played Australia at the Eden Gardens in Calcutta. And Australia had won the first test match. This was the second test match. Steve Waugh called it the final frontier. Australia hadn't won in India since 1969. We are in 2001. So Australia bat first, make a lot of runs, bowl out India cheaply in the first innings, enforce the follow-on, and then VVS Lakshman and Rahul Dravid just produced one of the greatest partnerships in the history of Test cricket. Bat a whole day and take such a massive lead that Australia are made to bat on the last day and they get bowled out. And that changed everything. Captains were just wary of enforcing the follow-on ever since. But it does happen off, on and off, like, you know, depending on, it also depends on how strong the opposition is, and like there are a lot of factors that go into that decision. But yeah, it always makes for exciting cricket, you know, because you expect the second team to, like, you know, fight back, but at the same time you're always hoping for a Lakshman Dravid thing to happen and for that to turn into this really exciting test match. I can breathe again.
I remember the first time I saw a follow-on take place, I was very confused because I was so new to it. And I was just like, why are they batting again? And then I heard the commentator say follow-on. So then I was like, Google, is a follow-on. So so that you explained it very way better than Google did. So thank you for that. But you are our resident Google. Maybe that's what I'll start calling you. And WWE had their Hell in a Cell pay-per-view this last weekend. So, Bharat, what is a Hell in a Cell match?
It is hell inside a cell. Like, so it's pretty much what it's meant to be. And cage matches have always existed in wrestling. I think they've been around from pretty much the inception of the format of the industry itself. But historically, cage matches were where two or more participants get thrown into the cage. And the only way to win is to climb over the cage and escape to safety. The logic being, look, you two have such a, like, you have a feud that is so wild at this point that, you know, you cannot settle it in a normal wrestling match. So we're just going to throw you into a cage and whoever can escape, escapes. Or it was also done for chicken shit heels, like, you know, who would cheat and win and cheat and win. And finally, the face says, you know what, the only way we're going to settle this for good is we'll get into a cage where there's no outside interference. And it was based around a chicken shit heel somehow trying to escape and going out. And because I never understood the whole logic. If I am the brave hero, why would I ever escape a cage and go? What does that make me? It makes me a chicken shit heel. So I was always confused by that. But then anyway, the WWE and Jim Cornette, of course, the great Jim Cornette, takes credit for the idea and the name Hell in a Cell itself. But, you know, like with most things wrestling, it's most things are rumor and innuendo, as Conrad and Bruce like to say. And the first ever Hell in a Cell match was Shawn Michaels versus The Undertaker. So in the difference between a cage match and a Hell in a Cell was the cage just covers the ring, like I said, and it's open on top, generally the cage match. Of course, WCW had World War III or War Games, where it used to be enclosed, but that used to be even a very, there used to be a little more ridiculous than a cage match. So someday we'll talk about War Games, but at least for me, I know there are some fans out there who love the War Games concept, and it was brought back by AEW. But anyway, so the Hell in a Cell the cage doesn't cover only the ring, but also the surrounding areas. So basically, you have to beat your opponent inside in a normal fashion, where, like, you know, by pinfall or submission, but you have to do it inside the ring, which is inside a cage. So the cage becomes a weapon in many ways. So you can use the cage to hurt them, maim them, smash their head against it, like, you know, smash their body against it. It just becomes an additional weapon. And also, it also generally means that there are no disqualifications. So you can use all sorts of weapons, as you would have seen in some of the Hell in a Cell matches this weekend. So the first ever one was Undertaker versus Shawn Michaels, though it was a great match. You know, that it was a great feud culminating into that. It is also famous for, you know, the arrival of It's Kane. Like, you know, that was the first sighting we saw of Undertaker's brother Kane, Glenn Jacobs, who's now mayor. So, yeah, it just changed. It just added, like, an extra element to wrestling itself. It just made wrestling more violent, or so we thought, because a year later at King of the Ring, when Undertaker and Mankind were put in a Hell in a Cell, we all know what happened. Mankind was, Mick Foley was cut in half. He's nearly died, literally, and not just because Jim Ross said so. But he survived, and, you know, Hell in a Cell matches just became a norm, not just in the WWE, but everywhere else. Though I think they have a trademark over Hell in a Cell, if I'm not mistaken. So that's a little bit about the history of Hell in a Cell. Did I miss out on anything, Ajay?
I don't think so. You covered it pretty well. And now it's so popular that they have a pay-per-view called Hell in a Cell, where they have two Hell in a Cell matches in one night. So that just shows you how popular that particular match got. And now it's time to go over the ropes. This is where we go over the ropes of the present back into the past. And brother, this one was a fun one. I was not watching cricket at this time, but I have seen highlights of this many, many times because of how amazing it was just to see, even in highlight form. And I would love to get your take on Brian Lara and his unbeaten 400 against England in 2004.
I was watching a lot of cricket back then, Rajiv, and I was watching the West Indies very closely as always. And, you know, one of the... And firstly, who is Brian Lara? Brian Lara is one of the greatest cricketers to ever played the game, one of the greatest batsmen to ever played the game, right? Alongside the likes of Sachin Tendulkar. And he was Sachin Tendulkar's peer. I think they're best friends to date, or one, like, you know, they're really close friends. And their careers really coincided with each other. I think they've made their respective debuts 2 years apart. And he, for many, many, many cricket fans around the world, he is still the most exciting batsman they've ever seen. Definitely for me, I was a humongous Brian Lara fan. You know, I did carry the infamous Lara Khiladi, Sachin Anadi, that word Khiladi again, Sachin Anadi poster, which is also based on a movie around Akshay Kumar, Tu Khiladi Main Anadi. And Anadi means a good for nothing fellow. And like, I carried a poster which said Lara, Khiladi Lara, the player, Sachin Anadi. And where did I do this? In Mumbai, in Sachin Tendulkar's hometown, where I'm from as well. And luckily, the security guard outside the Wankhede Stadium took it away from me and told the 8-year-old Bharat Sundaresan, dude, if you take this in, you're going to get bashed up. So I'll save you some physical harm. And he threw it away. I was only 8 years old, but he's right. I would have been beaten up. That's how a big Brian Lara fan I was. But that same year, we're talking 1994, Brian Lara had come to India as a multiple world record holder, where the highest individual score in Test cricket for the longest time was Gary Sobers 365. So Gary Sobers, again, another legend of the game, right alongside Don Bradman, considered the greatest all-rounder to have ever played the game. And Gary Sobers had made his 365 in 1958. Or 1958. So that record had stood for 36 years. And Brian Lara was ironically playing against England at St. John's ground, in recreation ground in St. John's, which is in Antigua, where he would, you know, once again reclaim the world record 10 years later. But 1994 is when he broke the record for the first time. Gary Sobers was at the ground doing commentary and he made 375. And Brian Lara was still a very young man. And it just, for that record to have stood for that long and to have been broken by a fellow West Indian left-hander who would turn out, become a legend, just was a special moment for everyone. And this is around the time West Indian cricket as a team was beginning to slip. So it was a big moment for them. And Brian Lara, the greediest batsman in the history of the game, went on to then make 501 not out in a first-class game, playing county cricket for Warwickshire. Which happened 2 months later. So within 2 months, he had broken the record for the highest first-class score, highest test score, making 375, and then gone on to make become the first man to make 500 runs in one inning. 500 runs in one inning. Just think about that. He was dropped early on. The catch was dropped. Imagine that, wicketkeeper's plight, poor guy. But yeah, so he was known as this batting run merchant. And that record stood, like Brian Lara's first-class record still stands. Nobody's made 500 after Brian Lara. But his test record was broken in 2003 when evil Matthew Hayden, the great Australian opener, scored 380 against Zimbabwe in Perth at the WACA against a semi-decent Zimbabwe attack. Zimbabwe at this point were not at the strongest. Zimbabwean team was in the late 90s, but by 2003, they had gone back. There were a lot of issues in Zimbabwe as a country and with their team, so they were not even close to full strength. But yeah, Matthew Hayden did what he did, made a big score, 380. So and so the one thing you had to hang your hat on, like the individual record of Brian Lara's, was also taken away from you now. And it was heartbreaking. But I have a very good friend in Trinidad called Peter Matthews. He's recognized as the greatest West Indies cricket fan ever. He's traveled the world with them. And Peter tells me, this is a fellow Trinidadian, just like Brian Lara, walked up to him and he said, in that lovely Trini accent, he said, hey, we walked up to Brian and we said, Brian, him can't hold your record for too long. It's your record, Brian. And then allegedly Brian Lara said, okay, for you, Peter, I'm going to break this record. And it just so happened that England were touring a year later in 2004. And they had a test match at the same ground, the St. John's Recreation Ground in St. John's, Antigua, which no longer gets used. What does Brian Lara do? He says, okay, I made 375. You made 380. I'm just going to become the first man to score 400 in Test cricket. And he just played one of his classic Brian Lara innings, laced with boundaries and like a lot of excitement. He had famously pulled Andy Caddick to get to go past Gary Sobers in 1994. This time he swept Gareth Batty, an off-spinner, to become the first man to score 400 or go past, or actually not go past. He finished at 400, not out, to reach 400. It was just one of those things. Of course, he went past Matthew Hayden's 380 prior to that. But the beauty was the late Bob Willis was on commentary both times. Bob Willis is great former England fast bowler. He was on commentary in 1994. He was on air in 2004 as well. Unfortunately, Bob Willis passed away last year due to cancer, but what a great man. Brian Lara, it's a big moment for me personally. I remember being very happy about West Indies reclaiming that one thing that they had to hang on to. And thankfully, nobody's really come very close to breaking that record since. So Brian Lara held his record for the first time around. 375 was held for around 9 years. But thankfully, the 400 not out has stood the test of time for 17 years now. The way Test cricket is going, I don't know if anyone can come close. There was a fear 2 years ago. I was covering that match right here at the Adelaide Oval, 2.3 kilometers away from where I'm sitting right now, where David Warner, another aggressive Australian left-handed opener, was toying with the Pakistani attack. But thankfully, the Australians declared, because it was a pink ball test and Tim Payne wanted his bowlers to bowl under lights, he declared with David Warner batting on 335. But the way Warner was batting, it looked like just a matter of time. So thankfully, the great Brian Charles Lara's record still stands, and hopefully it stands the test of time, and nobody ever gets to 400. That's me selfishly speaking.
Such great stuff, brother. I had a feeling that you had been watching that match, so I'm glad that I was right when I put these notes together. Well, thank you all so much for tuning in to another fun episode of Chop On. We really appreciate all of the love and support that we have been receiving. One more time, we drop every Wednesday in the U.S. at 8:30 p.m. EST, Thursdays in India and Australia at 6 a.m. IST and 10 a.m. ACST. Bharat, do you have any last words for our listeners before we head out of here?
Well, all I want to tell you is I have one more sleepless night ahead of me, but expect some bonus content. I have a sneaky feeling this World Test Championship final is not over yet. There's a lot more that could happen, and by the time you're hearing this, it would have happened, and you'll hear all about it from me. And thank you as always for all the love, and just a request, like, tell us what you think. Tell us what do you think we can do better. Tell us what you think we suck at. I'm pretty sure that list is not at all big. Maybe that list doesn't exist at all. But yeah, and tell us what we can add or take away from our format. I'm having a blast, Rajiv. I know you're having a blast as well. We're into week 9 now. And it's just getting better and better. And hopefully so is our listener base. And their interest, not just in wrestling, but also in cricket. And also not just in cricket, but also in wrestling. And there you go. If WWE, you're listening, Akshay Kumar and Rinku Singh, managing Rinku Singh, that's a WrestleMania main event.
If nothing else, it's a WrestleMania moment. And you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at ChopOnPod. That's where you can give us that feedback that Bharat is seeking, and I am seeking as well. On Twitter, he is at BeastieBoy07. I am at TheRajiv8. Keep chopping on, people.